Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, the walls have ears, but do they also have lungs?
Nicotine residues from smoking have been observed in household surfaces, and the concern here is that they further react with compounds found in the environment at home. Gases like nitrogen dioxide are now known to react with the nicotine residues and produce carcinogenic compounds.
Bibiana Campuseo looks at the evidence for third-hand smoke, carcinogens oozing out of the wallpaper. Also, how spider silk could hold the nanoscale key to water collection, what a pristine meteorite is revealing about the origins of the solar system, and painting the town red with McLaren.
A Formula One car is not produced once and then used throughout the season. The body itself changes as the season progresses, and that means constant changing of panels, aerofoils, etc., and they need to be painted. So if you are able to deliver paint that cures faster, it allows the engineers to have more time for finalizing the designs and getting them to the racetrack.
And you can hear Mark Korschmidt explaining how new paints are helping Formula One to go faster later in the program. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and also in this, the March edition of the Chemistry World podcast, are Bibiana Campuseo, Nina Notman and Phil Broadwith.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, home sperm counting. Sounds intriguing. Phil, tell us more.
Absolutely, Chris. Well, one of the major problems that affects couples trying to have children and failing is the possibility that the man's sperm isn't possibly as effective as it ought to be. And one of the things that might be wrong is that there just aren't enough of them, so they need to be counted. At the moment, what happens is that you have to take your sample to a hospital where a technician in a lab sits down with a microscope and physically counts the sperm. But obviously that's less than ideal. You've got to get your sample to the hospital relatively quickly, and there's a level of human error. You've got to start manhandling the samples and whatever, so it's not ideal.
OK, those constraints in mind, what's the solution?
Well, Lois Segerink at the University of Twente in the Netherlands thinks that the solution is to have an automated microfluidic device, and that's exactly what she's come up with.
Talk us through it.
Your sample of sperm is mixed with some polystyrene beads and then passed through a microfluidic channel which detects the electrical impedance of the solution that's going past it, and each kind of cell has a particular signal associated with it, as do the polystyrene beads. The polystyrene beads are at a known concentration within the sample. Therefore, if you compare the count of beads to sperm, you can get a concentration of the sperm.
And this is much quicker and presumably more reproducible than using a person to do that job.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't involve having to take your sample to a specialised lab. So, I mean, if you really wanted to, you could have one at home, or more realistically, we're talking about maybe a doctor's surgery.
When you say have this at home, are they actually in a position where this is a device that could be rolled out tomorrow, or is there still lots of development to do?
No, we're still at the sort of prototyping stage. Obviously, there would have to be some way of getting the human sample of sperm into the device.
Some people are a good aim, Phil.
Yes, but we can't count on that, Chris, so we need a slightly more reliable mechanism for getting it in there.
OK, well, we'll look to see how that turns out, because it will be interesting to see when they actually start trialling it, whether it does bear fruit. Anyway, thank you, Phil. Bibi, assuming that someone doesn't have a low sperm count and they do have some children, we're all told about the risk of second-hand smoke, but there's this new concept that you're saying is third-hand smoke. Tell us about this.
Yes, this new term has been coined to describe nicotine residues that deposit on household surfaces.
Nicotine?
Yes, nicotine residues from smoking have been observed in household surfaces, and the concern here is that they further react with compounds found in the environment at home. Gases like nitrous acid or nitrogen dioxide are now known to react with the nicotine residues and produce carcinogenic compounds.
So let me just check I've got this straight in my mind. The person smokes a cigarette, the materials that the cigarette produces, they breathe out into the air. They deposit on wall surfaces and other surfaces. They then come back off those surfaces at a different rate and react with chemicals in the air to produce things that can cause cancer.
Absolutely, that's exactly what happens. This group of researchers at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in California experimented in a truck. Actually, they used some cellulose inside a truck that was driven by a smoker, and they monitored the cellulose for 3 days. They took it to the lab and they found that 3 carcinogenic compounds had been produced as a consequence of the reaction that I was talking about. 2 of them had already been found in tobacco smoke, but the 3rd one is one that is not usually present in tobacco smoke, and toxicological studies are needed.
Do you know what's really worrying me about this, though, is that, you know, parents are pretty clued up. If you say to them, you're having some young children or you've got some young children, don't smoke around them, they'll say, yes, I don't. But I still smoke. I go outside. So this presumably means they're going to come in with that smoke material still on their clothes, perhaps even on their hair. And then presumably they'll just exude that into the air and they'll make those chemicals in the air in their house. So even though they've taken the main body of the smoke outside, there's still the effect going on indoors when they come back.
Absolutely. In the case of clothes or hair, you will obviously wash it frequently. But if you're talking about wallpaper, for example, you can have children exposed for weeks or even months. So it is a concern for sure. What hasn't been determined yet is how much of a concern it is.
Indeed, because I was going to say, it's one thing to show this can happen when you're using very sensitive pieces of equipment. It's another to prove it has a clinically relevant effect, isn't it? That there's enough of this being produced to then trigger a disease relative to all the other things we're being exposed to
absolutely.
From the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. At the moment, what they have shown is the chemistry, and then the next step would be to see how much exposure it generates. One of the concerns, obviously, with children is that they interact very differently from adults with their environment, and it has been estimated that their exposure could be 20 times higher than adults. So it is a concern, but we need to wait and see.
So if the walls are yellow, probably worth giving the room a miss. Thank you, Bibi. Now, how do you paint a Formula One car? Answer, quickly. Mark Korschmidt.
So in the past, paint is often being used for protection and aesthetics. That's been over the last centuries. And Sikkens is about 200 years old, so that's where it's derived from. However, you see more and more that performance is being used as a field for development for paint. Especially Formula One is critical. First and foremost, it's the substrates. These are not regular substrates as steel, aluminium, etc., used on cars, but more the modern materials, composites and carbon. Besides that, the paint has to endure tremendous heat, vibration, battering by stone, etc., from the track. On top of that, you also have to bear in mind that performance can be enhanced by using specific types of paint. But next to that, a Formula One car is not produced once and then used throughout the season. But what you see is that the body itself changes as the season progresses. And that means constant changing of panels, aerofoils, etc. And they need to be painted. So if you are able to deliver paint that cures faster than previous, it allows the engineers to have more time for finalizing the designs and getting them to the racetrack.
As someone who probably spent far too much time eroding brain cells by being exposed to these kind of things when I was a bit younger, could you just explain, when you put paint with a spray gun onto a surface, chemically speaking, what is actually going on?
Basically, paint is consisting of a system. You start with a primer for making sure there's a good bond and also a flat surface. After that, we apply the chrome, so that's the actual chrome look that you see, and that's basically color, but then a very special pigment, because if there's too much resin in there, then you get a dull silver-like look. So it has to, then it will be polished, and it really looks like high chrome, and that's just for the effect. We finish it off with a clear coat, which is a varnish, and it's a two-component product, and that is actually the product that ensures the color remains throughout the season, but it also provides protection for rain, for UV light, stone chips, etc. So basically it's a three-stage system.
In the old days, we used to be able to get away with putting just about anything in paints as long as it looked good. These days, the European Union are not so happy about that, and nor are the people who have to spray these things on. So how has this industry had to respond to changing regulation and changes in the rules about which chemicals you can and can't use?
In the industry of coatings, there's constant evolution, and every now and then followed by revolution. But what you see is that certain pigments are being restricted, like lead-containing pigments. And you see that happening throughout the industry on a constant pace. So AkzoNobel is continuously screening their raw materials for suspect materials, and where materials are suspect, so not restricted, we will try to minimize the use of it or even replace it with new alternatives. This is one of the key areas. On a chemist, so if it's on a molecule base, there is specific restrictions in place. First and foremost, it's a VOC emission, so the content of volatile organic compounds. You've seen in the past it could contain about 800 grams, 900 grams per liter. However, we are utilizing new technology, reducing the VOC content to 420 grams per liter maximum for the base coat and the varnish. The primer could be up to 540 grams, and that is a significant reduction from what it was in the past. And we use, for example, waterborne technology for that. But you see the environment being managed also on other areas. We are now using a new drying method, and that is revolutionary in combination with the paint, and that reduces the CO2 emission with about 80%. And why CO2 emission? Because the normal curing process of paint is by heating it up. So you heat the environment, the object up, and that obviously is normally using natural gas. And we've changed that system with McLaren. So therefore, the CO2 emissions caused by this heating up, which is significant, is reduced by 80%.
You mentioned that performance is important. Obviously, it's important in Formula One because fractions of a second determine who wins and who loses. But also, given the number of miles that the average car is driving on the road, if you can get a paint that is going to give slightly less air resistance, that presumably is going to translate into a huge environmental saving.
Exactly. So every small bit will contribute. Although I must say that the Formula One environment is so different than from a normal conditions of a car. You have to think about exposure. A Formula One car lasts maximum for one season, whilst the cars that you and I drive have to last for 10, 20 years. And the paint from ours has got a lifetime warranty. So then if you talk about air resistance and these kind of areas, we can make a sacrifice for Formula One, a sacrifice which we are not likely to be able to do so on a normal car, but also the speed generated. And air resistance has got a strict relation with the speed an object drives. And you can imagine that 300 kilometers an hour on a track is a little bit different than we can do on a motorway. We utilize this technology also in our marine protective business unit, where we, for example, apply it to the hull of a ship. And because it's such low friction, it reduces drag of the ship, and that saves up significant amounts of fuel consumption. And I've heard a number between 6 and 7% is feasible.
Which, of course, is going to translate into a direct reduction in carbon emissions and things. Do you get to try the F1 car?
No, but the dream is still alive, hopefully.
Well, as they say, you can but dream. That was Mark Korschmidt. He's from the Dutch paint specialist, AkzoNobel. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how scientists are tying molecules in knots and a revolutionary new battery design. But first, Nina. Now, not everyone likes them, but spider silk definitely likes water. Tell us more.
So Chinese scientists from the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing have been looking at how the spider silk catches the morning dew, and they published this work in the journal Nature. So one, they want to find out how nature works, but they also want to use the information to make artificial materials to capture water from air. So they've been looking at the hackled orb weaver spider webs using a scanning electron microscope, and they've found that the dry thread has loose hydrophilic puffs of very fine silk in particular places along its length. And when the web is exposed to water vapour, structural changes occur, so these puffs shrink and become rough, densely packed knots. And as the water kind of settles onto the web, it slides along the smooth silk and accumulates into the rough knot. So this is where the big droplets of water appear.
It's fascinating because that's saying basically a spider web is not a homogeneous structure along the length of each thread. There are these knots separated by these thin, slippery bits, which is why you get the water coalescing in these blobs.
Yes, that's what these scientists have seen, yes.
Do they think that this has got some kind of application or industrial application, or is this purely just an academic interest?
Yeah, they think industrially it could be useful for any kind of application where you'd want to collect water from air, and also from a chemistry point of view, they could be used as filters to draw substances out of chemical reactions.
If you wanted to do that, how would you do it?
So having looked at the natural material, they've now been trying to make artificial materials. So they've made an artificial spider silk of nylon fibres and coated it with polymers. And they've looked at the structure of this again under the microscope, and they've found that when it's dry, there's these really tiny knots. And when it's exposed to mist, it behaves in a very similar material to natural ones.
And what presumably collects water?
Yeah, and collects water in the same way. So they find that initially random droplets appear on the surface, and those kind of the droplets slide along the artificial spider silk to form the bigger droplets in the knot area.
So presumably then we're talking rain catching machines, mist filters to get water in areas where there isn't much rain then?
Hopefully so, yeah.
Do we know why the spiders do it though?
We don't know why the spiders do it. Because normally when people are looking at spider silk, they're considering its extreme strength, and people haven't looked into this before.
So I guess from one knotty issue, knots in spider webs, from Nina Knotman, to another knotty problem. It's actually tying molecules in knots. Phil, tell us about this.
Yes, Chris, you'd really struggle to see these kind of knots with an electron microscope. You'd need something a lot more powerful. We're talking about single molecules that are tied up into a true knot. And if you want to know what a true knot is, go and ask a mathematician, but be sure to have a pillow handy because it might be a lengthy explanation. Basically, it comes down to the fact that to be a true knot, you have to have all of the ends tied up together. You can't unravel the knot.
So a shoelace, a knot in a shoe, that's not a true knot then?
Absolutely not, no.
So what have they done to do this chemically?
OK, so what Chris Hunter and his group at Sheffield in the UK have done is take a long stringy molecule which has three sites that combine to a metal. When you add zinc to that, you get two of the metal binding sites make loops out of the sort of middle bit of the string. But then for the third one to get into position to bind, it has to physically thread through the loop. So you then end up with what's called an open knot. So it's the molecule's been tied up a little bit, but it still has the ends free.
Well, that doesn't fulfil the criteria then, does it, if it's got the ends free? So what do you do then?
So that's where the next stage of the chemistry comes in. You've got to try and tie those knots together. First of all, they tried using an ester bond, but the problem with that was what you really want to do is be able to get the metal out of the middle. When they tried to use chloride or lithium sulfide to get the metal out, it either just did nothing or it broke the ester bond. So what the group then did was to use alkene metathesis to close the loops instead. So you then have a true trefoil knot, which is a little bit like the sort of Celtic knots that you see. It's a very simplified form of that.
Beautiful, but what can you actually do with it?
Molecular knots are very interesting from the point of view of comparing them with things that happen in nature. There are certain proteins which are naturally knotted up, but they tend to be mostly open knots. The other thing to think about with these knots is that they are handed, they're chiral. So if you can make a knot structure which is itself chiral, and then you can decorate it with various other bits to do kind of catalytic chemistry or whatever, you can end up with a very rigid, very spatially defined catalyst, which should hopefully give you some interesting catalytic activity.
And just for the sake of argument, how big are these knots?
OK, well, if you were comparing them to, say, a drug molecule, they're a bit bigger than that, because you have to have enough length to kind of fold up on itself. But they're nowhere near the size of a protein molecule, for example. We're talking a relatively short polymer chain.
And given how hard they are to make, are we close to actually being able to make them in a viable way? Or is this just someone saying, we can do this, but it's going to be a little while before we can do anything useful with it?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of research is still very much at the early stages. People are still exploring what shapes we can make, whether we can make knots even more complex than this kind of very simple trefoil knot. So, yeah, we're still at the very early stages, and any kind of application is going to be a little way off. Because, first of all, you've got to be able to make one hand of the knot rather than the other. So that's another problem entirely.
So they've got the knot sorted. Now researchers just need the nano bow tie to practice on. Thank you, Phil. And now, here's Meera Senthilingam with news of another chemical offering from Chemistry World.
Each week, the Chemistry and Its Element podcasts bring you the tales, trials and tribulations behind the discovery and chemistry of the elements in our periodic table. So to give you a taster of what these podcasts reveal, I thought it best to share the element that some consider to be the king of the elements. Well, that's Brian Clegg's view, at least.
Forget 10 Downing Street or 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The most prestigious address in the universe is number one in the periodic table, hydrogen. In science, simplicity and beauty are often equated, and that makes hydrogen as beautiful as they come, a single proton and a lone electron making the most compact element in existence. Hydrogen has been around since atoms first formed in the residue of the Big Bang and is the most abundant element by far. Despite billions of years of countless stars fusing hydrogen into helium, it still makes up 75% of the detectable content of the universe. This light, colourless, highly flammable gas carries on its uniqueness by having the only named isotopes, and some of the best known at that. Deuterium, with an added neutron in the nucleus, and tritium, with two neutrons. Hydrogen is an essential for life, the universe, and just about everything. Without hydrogen, we wouldn't have the sun to give us heat and light. There would be no useful organic compounds to form the building blocks of life, and that most essential substance for life's existence, water, would not exist. It's only thanks to a special trick of hydrogen's that we can use water at all. Hydrogen forms weak bonds between molecules, latching on to adjacent oxygen, nitrogen, or fluorine atoms. It's these hydrogen bonds that give water many of its properties. If they didn't exist, the boiling point of water would be below minus 70 degrees Celsius. Liquid water would not feature on the Earth. Hydrogen was the unwitting discovery of Paracelsus, the 16th century Swiss alchemist, also known as Theophrastus Philippus Aurelius Bombastus von Hohenheim. He found that something flammable bubbled off metals that were dropped into strong acids, unaware of the chemical reaction that was forming metal salts and releasing hydrogen. However, the first person to realise hydrogen was a unique substance, one he called inflammable air, was Henry Cavendish, the noble ancestor of William Cavendish, who later gave his name to what would become the world's most famous physics laboratory in Cambridge. Between the 1760s and 1780s, Henry not only isolated hydrogen, but found that when it burnt, it combined with oxygen, or dephlogisticated air, as it was called, to produce water. These clumsy terms were swept aside by the French chemist Antoine Lavoisier, who changed chemical naming for good, calling inflammable air hydrogen, the gene, or creator, of hydro, water. Because hydrogen is so light, the pure element isn't commonly found on the Earth. It would just float away. The prime components of air, nitrogen and oxygen, are 4 and 16 times heavier, giving hydrogen dramatic buoyancy. This lightness of hydrogen made it a natural for one of its first practical uses, filling balloons. No balloon soars as well as a hydrogen balloon. The first such aerial vessel was the creation of French scientist Jacques Charles in 1783, who was inspired by the Montgolfier brothers' hot air success a couple of months before to use hydrogen in a balloon of silk impregnated with rubber. Hydrogen seemed to have a guaranteed future in flying machines, reinforced by the invention of airships built on a rigid frame, called dirigibles in the UK, but better known by their German nickname of Zeppelins, after their enthusiastic promoter, Graf Ferdinand von Zeppelin. These airships were soon the liners of the sky, carrying passengers safely and smoothly across the Atlantic. But despite the ultimate lightness of hydrogen, it has another property that killed off airships. Hydrogen is highly flammable. The destruction of the vast Zeppelin, the Hindenburg, caused by a fire, probably from static electricity, was seen on film by shocked audiences around the world. The hydrogen airship was doomed. Yet hydrogen has remained a player in the field of transport because of the raw efficiency of its combustion. many of NASA's rockets, including the second and third stages of the Apollo program's Saturn V and the space shuttle's main engines, are powered by burning liquid hydrogen with pure oxygen. More recently still, hydrogen has been proposed as a replacement for fossil fuels in cars. Here, it has a big advantage over petrol, of burning to provide only water. No greenhouse gases are emitted. The most likely way to employ hydrogen is not to burn it explosively, but to use it in a fuel cell, where an electrochemical reaction is used to produce electricity to power the vehicle. But even if we don't get hydrogen-fueled cars, hydrogen still has a future in a more dramatic energy source, nuclear fusion, the power source of the sun. Fusion power stations are tens of years away from being practical, but hold out the hope of clean, plentiful energy. However we use hydrogen, though, we can't take away its prime position. It is numero uno, the king of the elements.
Elemental royalty there, brought to you by science writer Brian Clegg. And you can hear more stories about the discovery and reactivity of the remaining elements, as well as the scientists behind them, by visiting the website at rsc.org/chemistryworld/podcast/element.
Mira Senthilingam, and you can also track down Chemistry in Its Element as a podcast on iTunes. In just a moment, how some carbon nanotubes and a bit of titanium dioxide look set to revolutionise lithium-based batteries. But first, Bibi, something that's out of this world.
Right, this story is about a meteorite getting a holistic treatment.
Well, what other kind of treatments can meteorites get then?
This one has had a lot of probing and testing, actually. It was discovered at the end of the 1960s in Australia, and at the time, the analytical chemists that were dealing with it and trying to get some data out of it were using all the technology that was at their disposal to try to get some information about it, generally biologically active components, see if they could actually shed any light into the potential sources of life on Earth. So they were.
Well, how old was the meteorite then?
It is. Allegedly, it's older or of the same age as the sun. So
born from the same primordial soup that spawned our solar system, basically. So therefore, things that are in it gave rise to us as well, ultimately.
Absolutely. The intention was to obtain information that would help us understand what was happening at those very early stages of the solar system, specifically looking at the chemistry that operated at or just before the birth of our solar system. So this meteorite would be very useful to analyse because of all the information that could be locked in. At the time, they were using a very targeted approach, which involved searching for specific groups of chemicals, such as amino acids. But the analysis that is being carried out at the moment by a group of researchers at the Helmholtz Center Munich in Germany is a non-targeted approach. So basically what they've done is they have used a new technology that has a very interesting name. The acronym is FTICR, which stands for Fourier Transform Ion Cyclotron Resonance. And they have analyzed the meteorite, weighing thousands of different ionized molecules with the accuracy of the mass of one electron. And their analysis have produced signals for over 14,000 different elemental compositions, which indicates, according to their estimates, that the meteorite must contain several million different organic compounds in total.
It's basically jam-packed with interesting chemistry, which predates the planet being here, arguing that the Earth was probably being fertilised from a very early stage with lots of interesting chemicals without having to make any of them. So this must give us some clues as to how things kind of got going that could have given us life processes, I presume.
Absolutely. I think the main conclusion of this study is that extraterrestrial chemistry diversity is very high compared with terrestrial biogeochemical chemistry. So the results at the moment are interesting in that they have shown that the meteorite was containing millions of different organic compounds. Now the hard task, in my view, starts, which is basically looking at what information can be extracted from that, or what compounds are we talking about, really.
There are many, many meteorites on Earth, though. So what makes this one special? Why are they so interested in this particular one?
The importance of this particular meteorite is that it was retrieved very soon after it fell on the Earth, which means that it wasn't weathered at all or affected by the Earth's atmosphere.
Oh, they saw it come down?
Yeah.
Fantastic. OK, thank you, Bibi. Well, we'll have to watch this space, I guess, to see what else they dig up from that meteorite. Nina, tell us about batteries.
So lots of groups we know are developing batteries with lots of storage capacity and are able to charge and discharge really far. So the technology which is mainly being used at the moment is lithium ion technology in laptops and in hybrid cars, but at the moment it isn't quite perfect. This work has been published in the journal Chemistry of Materials and is being done by a group based at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. The lithium-ion batteries, which we're all familiar with, have lots of lithium ions held in a typically graphite electrode. And when the batteries are turned on, the ions migrate to the cathode, sending electrons through the circuit. The problem with graphite is that it doesn't store that many lithium ions, and it also releases them very slowly.
What have they done to improve on that? Because one of the reasons why these batteries are not good is because the lithium ions have to wheedle their way in and out of that graphite, and it causes it to fracture, doesn't it, and break up, which is one of the reasons why the batteries clap out eventually. So have they got round that?
Yeah, they have. So this group have created carbon nanotubes that they've coated with titanium dioxide, and they've found that the combination of these two compounds creates really good anode material for the batteries. So
you've got a nanotube, so carbon nanotubes, long nanotubes, and they're actually physically coated round the outside with the titanium dioxide.
Yeah, that's right.
So what happens to a lithium ion in that setting then?
So the lithium ions can accumulate really nicely in the titanium dioxide. It's very good at holding the lithium ions. And then when the battery turned on, they can transfer into the carbon nanotubes and then shoot along them in a fast-release way.
How did they discover this? Was this trial and error?
Carbon nanotubes and titanium dioxide have been tried separately for this purpose and have proved to be unsuccessful for various reasons. But I think along their way, they realised that carbon nanotube did the fast-release part and titanium dioxide was very good at holding the lithium ions effectively and thought they'd have a go at combining the two and see how it worked.
So how much better is this than the existing electrode configuration? How many, is it to say 5 times, 10 times better than what we've got at the moment?
The researchers haven't provided that information, Chris, but the thing that they have mentioned is that storage capacity in particular is very good in comparison to the carbon nanotube and titanium dioxide on their own. So the synergy molecule holds 4 times as many ions as the titanium dioxide on its own and 3 times as many ions as carbon nanotubes on its own. In terms of the fracturing, which you mentioned earlier, they've done studies where they've repeatedly charged and discharged the material, and they've done it, done this 100 times, and they've found that material doesn't fracture.
Which is brilliant, isn't
it? Yeah, it's really good.
But the big question now is this viable to make? Because if this takes forever to make one tiny set of nanotubes decorated with the titanium compound, it's going to be really hard to make this industrially. Are they able to do this?
Well, they say that the process is really simple and it's really cheap, so yes, it should be able to be used industrially.
So maybe my laptop will last a little bit longer in future. Thank you, Nina. Well, that is almost it for this month, but we do have one very important part of the programme left to visit. So if you cast your mind back to last time...
Well, Chris, we thought we'd take things up a notch and go with chemical joke of the month. Well, what we want people to do is send in their favourite chemistry jokes. The more terrible, the better, really.
So basically, you tell a crap joke, and the worse it is, the more likely you are to win.
Well, the funnier, you know... But different people find different things funny, so we'll just have to judge it on.
And you'll pick one each month.
Yeah, so every month we'll pick what we think is the best joke and that person will get the Chemistry World goodie bag.
So we invited you to send in your favourite chemically-themed gags. Now, after we'd been through 3 sacks of mail and resuscitated Phil at least 5 times from laughter-induced cardiac arrest, I'm pleased to say the winning entry this month is, drumroll, a neutron goes into a bar and asks for a drink. Pulling out his neutron wallet to pay, he's surprised to hear the barman say, "Hey, buddy, for you, no charge." Thank you very much to David Gruer at the University of Alberta for that one. Meanwhile, if you have an affinity for cringe-inducing chemically relevant jokes, then please do send them in to chemistryworld@rsc.org. And you can, of course, also use that address to send us any comments, thoughts or feedback about this programme. The contributors this month were Phil Broadwith, Nina Notman and Bibiana Campaseo. The production was by Miracentha Lingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.